Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Nursing Uncensored. Your host, Adrienne Benning, invites you to listen in on real conversations about all things in the nursing world. This podcast is intended for nurses, nursing students, and allied health professionals, but non-medical folk will probably get a kick out of us too. If you like what you hear, subscribe and share. Hey, hey, welcome back to Nursing Uncensored, guys. If you are just joining us, welcome. If you are an old friend, yes, this is Medroom Chronicles. We just have a new thing that we're trying now. With that being said, we've also got a new website at nursinguncensored.com, so I would love it if you would go take a look, listen to old episodes, share it with your friends, check out our blog, send us an email if you really feel like you got something to say. I would love for you to check it out. So, today we're going to be talking to a really fun and interesting nurse named Dorothy. Dorothy has worked a really interesting mix of jobs that we're going to talk about today, from working in her early 20s at Planned Parenthood to her current work as a medical examiner investigator, investigating basically deaths. So we've got quite the variety of topics to touch on, and it was such a fun interview to do. It actually ended up being a couple hours long, so in true Medroom Chronicles fashion, and now the new legacy of Nursing Uncensored, we are going to split this into two pieces. So I'm going to bring you the first half of this interview and then come back next week to hear us cap it off with part two.
All right, that should take care of that problem. Now I'm like wired.
We're good to go.
I'm in the Nursing Uncensored studio, aka the guest bedroom in my house. I refer to it as the lab because it's like a mad scientist's room in here, and it's my closet because there's no way I could share a closet with another human being and still be friends.
So. I get that totally.
So yes.
Josh has his own closet upstairs.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are some things that are okay are okay to keep separate, and this way he doesn't have to worry about my things consuming him like an avalanche of stuff.
Right.
But also I use this room to record in, and it's kind of like an art studio, and it's chaos room in my Poshmark headquarters.
I love it. I love it.
All right. So let's get to the matter at hand here. Welcome to Nursing Uncensored. I don't know how much of that intro I'm going to release, but we're officially here. I'm here today with my friend Dorothy, who is a nurse. Yes.
Yes. Hello, yeah. Everyone.
Hello. And I'm actually very excited because you've had a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of jobs. You've had several jobs that I'm aware of that I think are really awesome. And I'm excited to talk to you today. So I would like you to please give us the perfect little biography of Dorothy and kind of your journey through nursing. Include what as much or as little as you'd like. I think you have such cool stuff to say.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be a part of this podcast, and I have been listening fervently in the last week or two.
And I well, thank worry, you.
And I'm going to listen now forever. So to make a very long story short, so I come from a family of nurses, and, you know, out of high school, I immediately rejected the medical field. And I went to college and had about 8 majors and wound up getting a degree in anthropology. But what got me into nursing was I worked at Planned Parenthood, And I realized that nursing was my calling. So then I went to nursing school. I started at, I was 30. But I finished that in 2011, and I've been a nurse ever since. So I started on a med-surg unit, which I know it's controversial, and many nurses have different opinions, but I'm really thankful I started on a med-surg unit so I could really get my nursing sea legs. Because, you know, in nursing school, I wanted to start in the ER, ICU, or like super exciting fields. And once I got out of nursing school, I realized I was not prepared for that yet. Not that other nurses aren't, but just I was not.
I'm in that boat with you. I'm the person that I was like, I wanted to master the basics before. I'm kind of in a specialty. I kind of started in a specialty, but we get a lot of med overflow. And so you really do kind of get this broad education when you get everything from like pancreatitis patients to like stroke overflow. Like there's something to be said about that kind of like, that kind of broad umbrella of patients that you see. So that's a good foundation. I'm there with you.
Some people, it's
okay to do it the other way, but.
Absolutely. Like I've had friends like love going right into a specialty and do really well. But for me, like I didn't have all that medical background. I wasn't an aide beforehand or anything like that. So yeah, that was helpful. I mean, during my first code on MedSurg, I was like, oh fuck, like I need a real nurse. And then I was like, oh wait, that's me. So then I was in MedSurg for like 8 months. And then I've always been interested in surgery. So I had an opportunity to move to the operating room, which was, so I worked in the operating room for like 3 or 4 years, and I did a variety of jobs in the operating room, like circulating. I did minimal scrubbing, but I got to learn how to do that. And then towards the end, I got the opportunity to be in charge, like a charge nurse, which was very interesting to say the least.
I remember being a nursing assistant because the OR is like right by the unit that I used to work on. And I remember occasionally running into you and being incredibly jealous that I didn't get to go behind the locked doors.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, there were a few times that I got to like, it was, you know, late and there was kind of like, I think it was for transplant and I took a patient down, wheeled them down to the OR. And there, I was able to like kind of sort of go inside. So of course, here's me, like my eyes big as dollar, like half dollars, like literally trying to like look down every hallway and in every doorway I can as I'm walking this patient to like wherever I was supposed to go. So yeah, there's this mystery around the OR for me. So I was like, oh my God, she's one of the OR people. Like, yeah, go into the hidden temple.
Yeah, we're like the OR is, I mean, I could go on for hours about each job I've had, but
you're welcome to. I'll record it all.
The OR is so fascinating because it's I mean, all specialties are super intense, but I mean, surgeons, while I've worked with some most of them are fantastic, but they are some of the most intense doctors that I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, it's like you have to learn your own communication with them, that's true of all doctors, I guess. But
yeah,
I definitely had some really interesting interactions with doctors in the OR. Like sometimes things get really intense and, you know, people swear and they throw things just like in all other specialties of nursing, but that was the most intense field that I worked in. So I did that for like 3 or 4 years. And then I moved to hospice, because kind of with the OR too, I've always been passionate about advocating for patients that can't speak for themselves. And all of where I have, where my career has led, it's all about being an advocate. just like how nurses are.
Which, okay, so I started in at the Emma Goldman Clinic. That was like my healthcare foundation. Similarly, you started at Planned Parenthood. Both provide comprehensive women's reproductive healthcare and also healthcare for folks of other, you know, sexualities and identities. So huge, huge, I think, foundation there is that kind of like that person having the right to advocacy and choice in all aspects of their care.
Absolutely.
And so I'm kind of drawn to that as well because I do palliative care. And so I have a lot of end of life patients that are unable to, like they're 100% dependent upon me and any family or other staff that are around. So there's really, there is this, I do feel like this need, like that I have to be an advocate, which, you know, is potentially difficult to do when you're working with like licensed, like physicians and other practitioners that maybe are strong personalities, kind of like what you're talking about in the OR.
Right.
So that's probably, I would imagine, you know, now that you've done it, it probably seems like no big deal. But at the time, I'm sure there were moments where you were like, do I speak up? Do I stand up for this patient against this person who's probably going to scream at me and throw something? Or,
right.
You know, these are things that nurses have to learn how to do. And I think that there's a point at which you like cross over and you're like, hell yeah, I'm going to stand up for my patient. I'm scared. I'm going to pee in my shoe, but I got to say something.
Oh, absolutely. Like so many times in any area, but yeah, like you have to be able to stand up to those doctors because you're the one that's seeing the patient most of the time. You know, they're just like popping in and out, doing the rounds. Not that they don't do an important thing too.
Right, right. And that's not at all to knock our physicians. They're our partners in care.
Right.
But, you know, I feel like I've gotten really lucky and I've worked with a lot, like our palliative physicians, they are absolutely advocates for our patients. And I'm really impressed by the dedication and commitment of some of the practitioners I've worked with, but it's true. Like as the nurse, you have to be able to say like their pain and control is not enough, whatever it is like this, we need to do something different.
Absolutely.
So I think we're really similar in that way. We're both. Yeah,
I agree. I agree about palliative care. I've worked, the palliative care doctors and the hospice doctors are really some of the most amazing doctors that I've worked with, mm-hmm. and they get it. But, you know, with hospice, my particular job, you know, I would be out in the community in a, like we were divided up into territories. So, I mean, you really have to have your nursing skills kind of locked up. I mean, of course you learn something new every day, but you're independent on your own, you know, at this patient's house and they're having these symptoms. So you have to know your drugs and what to do and in consultation with that doctor. And I know there is definitely conversations I've had where someone's in pain, we've tried to increase their pain meds and, you know, that's just not cutting it. And so the doctor's like, well, we just increased their pain meds. But it's like, okay, well, I've been here for 2 hours and that's just not cutting it. So mm-hmm. we've got to bump this up higher. So, you know, and one thing I found with hospice and palliative care doctors is that they really trust their nurses and other team members about like symptom management and what's actually going on because you're the eyes and ears of the patient.
Absolutely. And there have even been times, many times, as a palliative nurse that, you know, we have in the hospital setting, we have on-call physicians, so we can call and say, hey, this is what I need. Can you, you know, can we do this order? A lot of times if you're working with a physician that's not really familiar with palliative care, like if it's a resident or it's someone from a service that just doesn't, you know, like a hospitalist or a general medicine, not, you know, necessarily something they're doing on a regular basis. And you'll call and you'll say, well, this patient is having pain, secretions, agitation. And they'll say, well, what do you want to do?
Right.
And so there is this, and on night shift, it's even more so because we don't have our nurse practitioners sitting in the, you know, the office across the hall. And so
similarly with you out in the community, you don't have an on-call doctor that's just like hanging out in the hospital, you know, just waiting for someone to call, or, you know, I don't mean they're just sitting around waiting. You know what I mean? Like somebody right. at the ready. And so there's a lot of that discretion that you need to have, like what is appropriate, what is safe, how much pain medicine can I give them and have them still breathe at the end.
Right.
Of the night. So we're dancing in this very kind of fine line gray area. Can we use those terms together? It kind of is, because you want to keep them safe, but you also want to keep them comfortable. And sometimes I've seen some palliative patients that their pain is so intense that they can handle enough pain medication to kill an elephant, and they're better with it. Like they're actually comfortable and breathing, and you're like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
I would have died 86 milligrams ago. Like,
that is absolutely true.
So it's important that we really know our stuff, and that we're not asking for something that's dangerous, and that we're also asking for enough that we're doing the whole point of us being there is actually being served.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I know that you addressed this in a previous podcast, just about the amount of meds that you give is sometimes stunning. I know, like with hospice, a lot of times, like if we had two hospice doctors, and then a patient could also have their primary care doctor or their oncologist be their, you know, doctor that we deal with. Mm-hmm. But we had like a set of, which I'm sure you do also, of standing orders that they could sign, so we could titrate, you know, within the boundaries of this order.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you would have to go above that and of course call and get the order. But I mean, it was stunning to me. Like the first time I gave 5 milligrams of morphine as a new hospice nurse, I was terrified. And then, you know, I wound up giving 20 to 40 milligrams of morphine mm-hmm. Q1 hour to some patients to keep them comfortable at the end. And even higher, I think you and I talked about a patient that I had that was on 400 mics of Dilaudid, like Q48 along, or not Dilaudid, fentanyl. And then he had a Dilaudid PCA, and he was talking and interacting comfortably with his family.
Yep. Yep. I've had similar circumstances where, you know, without that medication, the patient is.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It's clearly in pain. Restless, unable to sleep, not really resting, tense, just you can just see the signs of pain. And then, you know, fentanyl drip, PCA, fentanyl patches, you know, plus Tylenol, plus whatever breakthrough pain medicine we give. And then they look good. And they're breathing at 16 to 20 a minute, and their face has relaxed, and they're not, you know, fighting every movement when you try to, you know, help reposition them. You can tell. And you're at the same time, you're like, oh my God, I'm giving you more morphine or more Dilaudid or more fentanyl. But this is where the judgment comes in. This is where, you know, your assessment is really critical in making sure that you're hitting that sweet spot for that patient.
It's
great when we have physicians and nurse practitioners and whoever else is, you know, writing orders, understanding that, you know, if I call you at 2 a.m. for more pain meds, it's not a light decision that I've made. Like, this person needs, like, we woke you up because we gotta, like, we're not cool over here. You know, I'm sure that you know, probably came across a lot of instances in doing home hospice where you were like, we need to make adjustments and we need to do them sooner rather than later?
Yeah, absolutely. Or you have to have a lot of trust in your nurses. And I know that I've done things because they needed to be done. And then I called the doctor and was like, hey, so I increased this because they were having these symptoms. So this is what I did.
Right.
Obviously you can get in trouble for that probably, but I worked with some really, doctors that trusted my assessment skills.
And that's just it. You have to know your physicians. If it's a physician on call that I've never met before, I'm not going to call them. Or I'm not going to just write an order without calling.
Right. If it's
a doctor that I've worked with for 10 years, or, there are other nurses that I work with, they've worked on the unit for 20 years. Like, they've known those doctors since they were residents. The doctors know that these nurses are competent and able to assess what is needed. And so in some circumstances, I'm never going to advise a nurse to do this without the consent of a physician. But some doctors, after you've worked with them for a number of years, they're going to be like, why are you calling me for Benadryl? Just put the order in. As long as they're not allergic, they've had it before, just put the fucking order in and let me go back to sleep.
Right. Exactly. Yes. I want to stress to you, I don't advocate going out of your scope of practice and doing whatever you want, but
there are also times when your physician is going to be like, yes, they had Tylenol their last hospitalization 2 weeks.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Or they can have Senna,
Yes. The colace is fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. As long as they're not allergic.
Yeah.
So don't go increasing the morphine like they're
right. No, no, no. I treat my narcs like a grenade with the pin out. I'm just like, I need to put this in your body or I need to waste it. We're all over the place here, but I love this.
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. This is the way it always goes. If you've listened to other episodes, you know that there's no strict format here.
Yeah. Well, we could get off on any series of topics.
That's because literally everything you've done, I have like 8 trillion questions. So, but I want to keep moving along so we can kind of like, we'll come back to things, but I kind of want to finish your timeline. Okay. So you did a home hospice.
Yep. I did that for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then through that, my current job is in death investigation, which I kind of got into from hospice, and it is the coolest job I've ever done. It's like I get excited to go to work every day. My current boss came to speak to a hospice nurse meeting because a lot of times hospice deaths may fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner when they die. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a general explanation about that. In my state where I work, we are a medical examiner state. So that means every county has its own medical examiner. And the county I work for I'm pretty fortunate. Our medical examiner is actually a forensic pathologist. And then we have 2 deputies, but each county in my state has a medical examiner. So what the medical examiner does, just the basics, is to determine the cause and manner of death. So the manner of death, there's, 5. So that includes natural, accidental, undetermined, suicide, and homicide. So for instance, an example of, a hospice death that may fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner would be, let's say the hospice patient had a fall like 2 weeks before they died and they fractured their hip. They did whatever treatment they wanted to do, but that would fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner at the time of death because that would change their manner of death from a likely natural death to an accidental death. So if their hip fracture contributed to their decline.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And actually, this is essentially saying for example, just to elaborate on this a little bit more, I'm going to create a tall tale here about no one in particular. So say that person is, in a nursing home.
Uh-huh.
And that nursing home
hadn't checked on the patient. Like, for example, say there was negligent behavior, okay, and that patient hadn't been checked on for a number of hours. They had to go to the bathroom. They got up, they fall. So that would be something that would be, tell me if I'm wrong, that would be something that would fall under an accidental investigation, because then the question would be, was the nursing home negligent in their care? Am I getting too far off base? Is that too specific, or is it, it's looking for the reason, like the contributing factors, I guess?
Correct. Okay. It's not looking for the potential criminality of the nursing home.
Sure. It's, and maybe my example was bad for that reason, but I guess say I was in a bar fight and I fell and I hit my head and I got a head bleed. Or was I drunk and I fell, or, you know, who was like, what was the contributing factor? Is that
exactly? Yes, you're absolutely.
Was it an accident? Did somebody do this on purpose? Was it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what, and so basically in my state, and I think it's similar in all states, but I can't speak for them, but yeah, I mean, those are the questions we ask. Like, we want to, like, we respond to any death that's unexpected, basically, whether that be at home or in the hospital, or wherever that death occurs. So outside, you know, people are found in bodies of water, or, mm-hmm, I mean, wherever they are is where we respond to.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, so like back to your example about the nursing home, whenever I speak to nursing homes, they think that I'm some sort of regulatory body, which we are not. But like, if I get a request, for a cremation permit, which all funeral homes call the medical examiner to get a cremation permit, I have to kind of research that death to see if there's anything non-natural about it, like a fall or something. And so let's say, like the instance you described, there was a fall. So I call the nursing home to get a little background information. And I think a lot of times nursing homes are afraid to talk to us, and we're not looking for criminal negligence. Like, we're just saying like, oh, they had a fall, they got a right hip fracture, and then 2 weeks later they died. So then what I will do is talk to their treating physician and say, hey, do you think that that contributed to their death? And then if they say, you know, whatever they say, then I take all of that information and then I call the county medical examiner, in my case, the forensic pathologist, give them the circumstances of the death, and then they can make the ultimate ruling on the death.
Got it.
Okay. Just so it's certified correctly.
So that even dispels a myth that I had, because I thought there was some level of like fault finding. And so that actually sheds a very different light on the job to me, because you're literally just determining why. You're not determining who's at fault, or you're basically saying like, would this guy have had a heart attack anyway, or was, you know, something else involved here? Like, so do you guys look at toxicology, physical evidence? Like, what are some things that you look at? Medical records? Like, what are some things that are part of your investigation, I guess?
Yeah, we look at all of that. So, I mean, and to be a death investigator, you do not have to have a medical background. However, I've felt it's really helpful because, you know, you get nurses or PAs or NPs or, you know, doctors, you know, obviously you get medical processes that can contribute to someone's death. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to be from a medical background to do this. We do like kind of a fact-finding investigation, like, okay, so this person, they've been feeling crappy for the last month, and they've had these tests, and they had a, you know, let's say they had a DVT that they were being treated for, and then they had a fall, and then they got a head bleed, you know, like, mm-hmm, how is it all connected? Mm-hmm. So like in that circumstance, it might be ruled accidental, but that is not up to me. That's up to the medical examiner.
Sure.
So I look at medical records, I go physically to where they're at, and interview people. I interview family members, mm-hmm. or, you know, like the last people that saw the
sure.
person that we call the decedent. So yeah, I mean, that doesn't mean that regulatory agencies won't get involved in deaths. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on, like, yeah, if there is some form of neglect, yeah, DHS has certainly been involved in DIA, but they don't have anything to do with determining the cause and manner.
Sure, sure. So that's actually, that's such an interesting job. You've had this whole kind of, and that's what you, that's the work you do currently is
yes.
For the medical examiner. So you've had this string of, I think, really cool jobs. And they've all kind of been, you know, while you wouldn't look at those in a basket and go, oh, all of those jobs are all the same.
Right.
The lineage makes perfect sense.
Well, thank you.
Well, I just think it's really cool because, you know, like I said, we have some similarities. We both got to start in like reproductive health care and, you know, kind of started out as nurses, even though I was a nursing assistant for a long time, which gave me a great head start, but still the nursing part was new to me. And so in that respect, I'm coming up on my second year as a practicing nurse.
Yay.
Yes. Very
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, my journey is still at the beginning. My boss referred to me the other day as a junior nurse. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, you're pretty amazing. So
I think that all good nurse, I shouldn't say all good nurse, I shouldn't say all anything. Nothing is true about everybody. But I think a lot of times, you know, nurses that really care, that really give a shit ferociously, sometimes have a hard time feeling like they do a good job. Because we always feel like there's more we could be doing.
Oh, absolutely. I constantly critique myself on, it's like, you know, hindsight is 2020 because you go back and you're like, I should have done this. Like, why didn't I do that?
Yeah. And then once you're old enough that you can say that about a few different times in your life, you're like, but also, you know, you need to keep chugging forward and find the things that make you happy. And it sounds like the job that you have right now, even though these are really tough things to see and things to investigate, and there's probably some stuff that's, you know, heartbreaking that
does
happen. But also your sense of impact must be pretty solid. Like, you're actually there to help, you know, because for example, if I had a family member that died suddenly and I had no idea why, that sense of closure, that sense of knowing what happened, like, oh, it was an aortic aneurysm and, you know, that's why. And it wasn't, sometimes just knowing what it was that happened can bring such a sense of like understanding and kind of, like I said, closure, like some ability to move on.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, well, one, I think to be involved in this kind of job, or even, I mean, maybe hospice, I'm not speaking for all nurses because like we've said, like every nurse is different and has their own experiences. But, you know, for me personally, I'm really comfortable with the idea of my own death. Like I don't want to die, mm-hmm. but I know that it's going to happen.
Same.
And so it's just like, you know, still being this advocate for someone that can't speak for themselves anymore, mm-hmm. and helping their families to get answers. If you can, because sometimes, you know, circumstances happen where you can't conclusively say that it was absolutely this that they died from, mm-hmm. Which is called undetermined, where you don't have, you know, enough conclusive scientific evidence to say, yes, they had opiates in their blood and it was at this level that killed them. You might not get those answers. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of tough. That kind of happens in circumstances, sometimes where it, you know, there's a bunch of things that happened to this person. And so you can't conclusively say that it was one certain thing that led to their death. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Like where there's just too much stuff going on to figure out what it was. And I suppose, you know, I keep saying like, oh, that probably gives a great sense of closure. Yeah, maybe for some people it doesn't. But, you know, I feel like it's still an incredibly important job. And I'm sure that even though those cases, those undetermined cases, or, you know, even I mean, any of the cases can be really hard depending on the circumstance, but you know, that's true with any nursing job. Like,
right.
You know, none of us are immune to those hard things, those horrible diagnoses, the sudden losses of people, you know, that were unexpected accidents. And, you know, just recently with celebrities, you know, bringing everybody's attention back to suicide. There's so much stuff that happens that maybe we're removed from. We don't think about it. We think of it in like a CSI kind of way. Like, oh, there's like a cool lab somewhere and they're trying to figure out how people die. But it's real life.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You know, it's real life. Right. Like they really want, you know, this is real shit that happens and it's sometimes really devastating. And, you know, people that fill roles like the role you fill, you know, even if there are times we can't give people answers, the times that we can,
right.
I imagine make it worth it to go through all of the like hard stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I've had some really, some of my best family interactions, and that's not to say that I haven't had those in my other areas of nursing that I've worked in, but have happened at some of my best decedent and family interactions have happened at this job because they just are thankful to know that, you know, you give a shit, you know, mm-hmm. like, and that it's important to you to provide them with respect and to find out, you know, what happened to them or what, you know, led to their death if it's not immediately obvious.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like my boss said that, you know, we are dealing with families like on the worst day of their life, you know, because most times like it's unexpected. You know, especially like in emergency room deaths, you know, like, so you're walking into like a high stress situation.
Oh yeah.
And then you're having to ask them all these intrusive questions about their loved one when, you know, they really don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
So, but that's true of all nursing, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, you're seeing people, whether they're coming in for, it's true. When you're in the emergency room, it's like, what do they call, they call it like emergency room syndrome where like your blood pressure automatically goes up when the second you're like anywhere near a doctor or a nurse.
And that happens to me as a patient, like it skyrockets.
I got my TB test placed the other day and I like turned my head and the medical assistant kind of like giggled a little bit. I was like, I know, I'm a nurse. I'm not lying. Like when it's my body, it's different. I can draw blood all day long. But the minute you want to poke me, I'm like, I don't want to look.
Right. I'm so with you. Like just any of it. It's like, and you know, like in my mind, I like, you know, 99% of healthcare practitioners are fabulous, but you know, it's like, if I don't know you, like I want to make sure you know what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
That's why nurses are the worst patients. We are
absolutely. And you know, it's funny. So with my trips to the vet with my dog recently and just like other interactions, Doug laughed at me the other day. Most of the time as a nurse, like if I have a nurse at the bedside, like a patient's family member, I don't want to know because what's either going to happen is you're either going to tell me how to do my job or I'm going to feel like you're watching me.
Right.
And so, but I get, but the thing is because I'm still a new nurse and I don't meet a lot of new people all the time. So when I just meet someone, I want to be like, I'm a nurse. I know you can say these words to me. Like, it's okay. I understand. And I try to hold back, But like the other day we were at the vet's office and I was like asking, I wasn't trying to be a snot. I wasn't like using my nurse mouth. Like, but you know, I was like, okay, you know, I used some words that maybe most people don't use. And she was like, are you a medical professional? I was like, I'm a nurse. And Doug was like, you always got to throw that in there.
But, oh, girl, I hear you. I still do it. And
because to me, like, it's not to be like, I'm a nurse. I know this stuff. I'm just like, I'm a nurse.
Yeah, like, I want to learn more, you know? Yeah. And I get it. I get it. So, it's like, you don't, you know, it's like, you don't have to simplify the terminology for me because yeah. I get it, you know?
Give it to me straight. Tell me about layouts and stuff.
Exactly.
My friend Allison and I talked about that in one episode where she was like, I'm going to need a printout of my lab so I can geek out over them with my classmates because she's like taking all, she just finished all her prereqs and she's about to start nursing school. So she's like, I'm going to need a copy of those to take, like, I need to know what my WBT count is right now, please.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that you ever lose that. I mean, I'm not that much further ahead of you, but I'm the same way. I've stopped though. Like when I see someone in the community, like, possibly going to die, I am kind of hesitant now to establish that I'm a nurse.
No, if I'm in a bar and somebody falls down, I'm like, unless you code, you're on your own. Like,
right.
You got yourself in this mess. I'm not nursing your fat lip in the bar. Nope. Too bad.
Right. Exactly. Yep. It's like, you got yourself in that your own.
Like, if somebody was seriously injured, I'd be the first to respond. But otherwise, nah, you're a grown up. Call an ambulance. It's fine.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, we laugh, we joke, but this is some heavy shit. Like, this is some serious stuff you're dealing with. So I want to kind of put you on the spot. We talk a lot about, you know, how important it is as nurses to be able to give to other people. We have to be in good shape ourselves. So I want to know, what are some things that you do, whether it's like consciously or stuff that's just habit for you now? What kind of stuff do you do to kind of decompress and deal with the fact that, like, you're dealing with death on the regular? Like, for some people, they're like, no, I can watch CSI, but then I turn it off and I go over and I watch a comedy. Like, what are some of your coping mechanisms? And self-care is, I think, better, more so than just coping, but like, how do you keep yourself happy and in good shape so that you can be an effective person?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely important. And I would be lying if I didn't say I didn't drink, but that's not my
main coping mechanism. We want coping mechanisms.
Yes, that's my only, that's so healthy. No, like getting outside for one. I mean, like, we both have dogs, we both have animal friends. Getting outside for me is the best way for me to decompress, and hanging out with friends and doing things like this, like talking about it. Not just like being inside my own head, like being like, oh, I'm a weirdo because I love death. You
know? Oh my God. If you could see my bookshelf, here's the thing though. And I've said this before, and I posted this on Facebook. There was somebody who was talking about recently in Iowa City, you probably already know about this. Some folks in town went through a death doula training workshop.
Yeah.
And I am fascinated about that. I'm trying to, I'm potentially getting in contact. I don't want to say much because I don't know who's going to want to talk to me about this, if anyone, but I'd like to talk to them about this. But the thing that I've said before is that there are two things that kind of universally unite every human being, and that is that we are all born and we all die. And when we are born, if we are lucky, you know, we have people gathered around us celebrating the fact that we exist. Like, we're born, we haven't even done anything cool yet. Like, we can't communicate, we're just this little thing, and we're kind of useless to people, but everybody loves us and wants to see us. And then kind of we live our lives and we do all these cool things, I hope, and we have people that love us, and then we end up on our deathbed and nobody's around. I shouldn't say nobody. There are families that definitely rally around their loved ones, but we don't celebrate people's lives at their death like we do at their birth.
Right.
And so there's this entire kind of movement and way of thinking for people about how we need to be better as a society about how we interact with death.
Absolutely. Like I have said that time and time again, because it's like death is so uncomfortable for a lot of people to talk about. And even though it's inevitable, mm-hmm. yeah, we need to like demystify. I mean, obviously you don't know what happens when you die, but like right. the circumstances leading up to death, like,
right. And also, you know, a lot of families, like, you know, I'm taking care of patients in the hospital that are actively dying. Like right. their body is going through the process and people don't know what that looks like. So there are some right. symptoms that I have to say, like, this is not them in distress. You know, this is a normal part of the dying process for some people. And this is what we can do to minimize. Like, for example, you know, people's secretions build up in their throats.
Sure.
And it's this horrible sound. It sounds like they're underwater. But what it is all that shit in the back of their throat rattling because they can't clear their throat or cough. And so if they're laying on their back, all that shit pools. And then it's the most horrible sound for a family to listen to for days or hours or however long their family member is in the dying process.
Right.
And so people are like mortified. And I would be, you know, if I had no idea, that's a scary thing.
Right.
But it just shows that like 100 years ago, people died at home. And when this happened, you had ways of nursing the person you loved. And now, you know, people are in hospitals and there are nurses to take care of that. And God bless the family members that are like, I will give my mother her bath, or I will give my sister, you know, a hand massage, or whatever, people that are actually involved. And so I think these death doula courses are important. I think that, you know, education, hospice in the community is so vital, because I know nurses that have become nurses because they were like, I saw my grandma's hospice nurse and I thought she was the raddest person in the world and I wanted to do that too.
Right.
So
absolutely. Like Oh,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, I like just to like dovetail on that. Like, yes, like, you know, care, like home caregiving is, I mean, when you have a patient, their family kind of becomes your patient too, mm-hmm. you know, like caregiving yes. for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And especially like if they choose, like if the patient's like, I want to stay at home, that's really important to me. And the family is on board. And is able to do that, like it's all about like you have to teach them to also take a break and caregive mm-hmm. for themselves, you know?
Absolutely. And
because dying is not a quick thing like you see on, you know, TV, like on Grey's Anatomy or ER, where someone just shuts their eyes and they're dead.
They say something poignant and then
right
and they're gone. Right.
Right.
No, that's like, not the way like, it happens.
Like and, a few of us are fortunate, you know, like to die like in our sleep. So yeah, right. like understanding the mm-hmm. process is what we need to talk about more, I think.
Yeah. And I'm
comfortable with that.
And I, you know, I think that it's interesting when I have patients, family members come up to me and say, I was reading this book. I actually had a family member come up to me once. This is a true story. They came up to me and said, I've been reading this book about people dying. And it said that sometimes they had a big family. The family was there 24/7. And that family said to me, like, I've read that sometimes people will wait until there's no one around and then they'll die. And I said, well, you know, sometimes that does happen. Like these are trends that other people have noticed. You're not wrong.
Right, right.
And so they went and they said a little prayer around this family member. And then they said, you know, they said to this dying family member, we love you. We're going to dinner. If you want to go, that's okay. And I swear to God, not more than 30 minutes after they left, she died. And she was comfortable.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the family was like, please call us even if we're at dinner. And I called them and they came back and they were so grateful and they were able to say their goodbyes. But it's just interesting that was kind of like the catalyst for that was that they were kind of like, so we've heard that sometimes this, and it's like, yeah, more power to you for educating yourself and thinking about your loved one and thinking about like that connection that you have to them. And, you know, everybody's going to have a different kind of spiritual connection or whatever it is that they're experiencing or they believe in. But it's really cool when people are like, I feel like maybe we should try this. And then they get that resolution from it.
Yeah.
And I remember what they look like and that whole damn family who I loved, they were great. They lined up and hugged me one at a time. So,
oh yeah, that's like, and that's something they'll never forget you, you know?
And that's just it. I remember the nurses involved, you know, the professionals that I interacted with when my dad died when I was 20. And, you know, I have no idea who they are. I could never find them again, even if I wanted to, but I remember what that woman's voice sounded like. I remember exactly what she said to me. And I've thought before, like, I might become that person for this family. So I better watch what I do and what I say and like really be careful with my intentions.
Right.
Which is a lot of pressure, but also I feel like it's kind of a gift. Like I'm being entrusted with this and I'm going to do a good job to the best of my ability. So that's kind of my cheesy philosophy, but I think it's true. We need to not be like, oh my God, they're dying. I can't go. Yeah. We're all scared. We're all scared.
Right.
But yeah, we need, so I think that it's important that we have these discussions and that we also talk about, you know, how to cope with this shit when it is really hard. It's easy for me to say this about a patient that I've known for a few days or even one shift. It's a lot more difficult when it's someone that you've known your entire life or someone that you hold very dear to you.
Right. Right. Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Like what I do now, like in death investigation, like I've also lost my dad like suddenly. And, you know, I think like that experience, while unpleasant for me, like I've had loss and I've lost other people that were dear to me in my life. So knowing what that feels like, I think is helpful to me in this job. And in hospice and palliative care too, because, you know, like not everyone, I mean, the stages of grief are real, y'all. Like you know, I mean, there's some people are going to be angry at you and that's okay. You know, like I deal with a lot of people that are angry that their loved one is dead and that's okay. Like,
and you realize it's not about you.
Yeah, right? It isn't about me at all. Yeah. Like, so it's like, okay, I understand that, but I'll give you some, you know, some time. You know, and I'm just honest with them. It's like, hey, you know, if they're going through that anger phase, I'm like, I understand that the last thing you want to do is talk to me. You know, I get that. So whatever you need to do, I'll give you that space. You know, but unfortunately I just have to, you know, I'll make this as brief as I can, but I still, you know, need to ask you a few questions when you're ready.
Right. And I mean, I've often thought whether people are sad or upset or just really not emotionally interacting with me at all. They're just like shut off. I realize I'm a facilitator and I still need to do the job that I'm there to do. Doesn't mean that everybody has to like give me Hershey kisses and hug me when they leave. Like some people are not settled and I get that. And it is really real. And you have to kind of develop that thick skin. You have to have thick skin, but a tender touch, you know, like you have to understand that this person's you know, even if they get really upset, you'd probably be upset too. And so,
Like think about what it's like to be, you know, it's not about you, like you said, like it's think about what it's like to be in their shoes.
Mm-hmm. You also have to remember that like sometimes when people are in the stages of grief, they are unable to, like, for example, you know, when you're upset about, regardless of what stage of grief you're in or how you're feeling, you know, these things, these investigations, these causes, these determinations can potentially down the road be helpful to us.
Right.
And so we may not be able to hear it in that moment, but that's why they're counting on us as professionals to do what we need to do appropriately. So not bulldozing an upset family member, like knowing when to push and when to pull back and like learning that kind of rhythm of how people respond to these things. And, you know, it's that body language. If that person is suddenly like making a fist and their knuckles are turning red, you back the fuck off.
Right. Like the first thing
to know how to assess your nursing assessment.
Yes, that's so helpful. And I mean, the first thing I say, and I genuinely mean it, is that, you know, I introduce myself and I, right off the bat, I say, I'm so sorry that this happened. And, you know, like, because I do give a shit, you know, like I know this is awkward for everyone, but you know, it's like, I want you to know that I'm empathetic and that you might not want to do this at this time, but it's important for these reasons. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, like, you know, we deal with child deaths, and infant deaths, and, you know, in my state, the code states that any child death under the age of 2 is, there's required autopsies and then there's recommended autopsies. So a child death under the age of 2 is a required autopsy. So obviously it's upsetting that their child died, and then it's upsetting again that they have to have an autopsy. Right. But sometimes, you know, there could be like a genetic component that they weren't aware of that we might find on autopsy that, you know, they can get tested for, their future children can get tested for, right. You know, and I
again,
mean,
those benefits that we may not see when we're
exactly.
In grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, and it's all to help determine cause and manner. And so like, if you want, you know, we have to, for certain deaths, I mean, I'm, you know, we just have to do these things. And you know, to help you figure out why your loved one died. Mm-hmm.
Man, that seems like such a hard job, but also so rewarding. I mean, I feel that way about all nursing jobs, really. Like, there's nothing that I'm just like, boy, she's got it easy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've never talked to a nurse that I've been like, that seems like you don't even need to try. Like, there's always some level of like, oh, you got to do that too?
Right, ooh. Yeah. Like
but
one of my
still, but you're such from an outside perspective, you're such I don't want to say like you're such a happy person, because that's my label from my perception, and you know, it's not like we see each other every morning, but I think that you know, like the first thing you said was, I love my job, I'm happy right. to go to work, and I think that that's one of those things that 99 out of 100 people are going to be like, how did she do that?
Right,
how did she get to a spot where she's like, you're excited to go to work? What kind of meds are you on? No, you know what I mean? I'm joking.
Right.
But,
no, I
but
get
I'm
I get
like,
it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's some days I'm like, oh God.
Well, I yeah. Guess, I mean, we know. All have those. Yeah.
But it's like when I get a page that there's a death to investigate, like, it's like, oh, what's, you know, like my sick morbid mind is like, what kind of death am I going to be investigating mm-hmm. today?
Do you get butterflies? Like, do you get nervous? Like,
yes.
Scared? Like,
oh yes, yes. I've had, I mean, you go into all sorts of environments, mm-hmm. like, you know, for different deaths. And I, like, unfortunately I can't talk about specific ones,
but of course not. No, that's okay. That's okay.
But I've had like, you know, deaths outside, like mm-hmm. that are rather strange. And it's like, you know, and that's why we do a complete scene investigation, which includes like taking photographs and looking through things to help determine, like, you know, was there any kind of note that they left, or was there evidence that someone was drinking or doing mm-hmm. drugs or doing a certain thing?
Sure.
Like, what happened to them? What can I glean from their environment to figure out how they wound up here?
Right.
Like, where they died.
Right.
And so that's just all completely fascinating to me.
So do you ever work with law enforcement directly? Like, are you ever, like, for example, at a medical examiner scene that it's, and again, I don't want you to reveal anything about anything
sure.
specific, but are you ever in an experience where you're like at a crime scene?
Oh, absolutely. We work with law enforcement a majority of the time at scene deaths, which occur in the community. And you know, we also go to the hospital, and if there is some sort of criminal element to the death, and usually law enforcement is aware, but sometimes we notify them.
Like an assault or right. something like that. Okay.
Yeah, like yeah. some sort of homicide. So yeah, we work with law enforcement, we work with firefighters, we work with DHS. It's like innumerable, the different types.
The different ways that you could be involved yeah. in our agencies. Sure, right. sure.
Yeah. So that's so law enforcement in my state and law enforcement controls the scene. So like if someone dies in the community at their home or outside or like the
wherever.
Scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the law enforcement is in charge of that. And then the medical examiner has jurisdiction over the decedent. So the person and what's on their person. So technically by law, if someone dies like outside or in a motor vehicle crash, they are not supposed to be moved until the medical examiner arrives. Mm-hmm. However, that's not always possible. Like a motor vehicle crash on the interstate, you know, if you need, sometimes decedents, people get moved and that's okay. But so I mean, basically when I get there, I'm focused on where that person is and what are the circumstances around them. So I talk to law enforcement, I get the circumstances, I talk to family if they're available, and then I take a routine series of photographs. And then if it's something that's going to be autopsied, because that, like I said, there's required and recommended ones, I will transport the decedent back to the autopsy facility. But I mean, at some point in this process, I'm going to call the medical examiner because ultimately it's up to them. But you know, like certain deaths I know are automatically going to be an autopsy. So I'm going to coordinate with the medical examiner as soon as I possibly can.
So does that mean potentially calling the ME in like the middle of the night?
Sometimes, like if there's any question in the middle of the night, since our doctors are really great to work with, like if it's a infant death, I will call them. Otherwise, I'll just transport the decedent and then I will write up my report and then email them or, you know, text them and say, hey, this happened. Call me when you wake up.
Interesting.
Because the autopsy is not going to happen until the next day.
Right. So it's not like it has to be done right now.
So
my curiosity, and you can choose whether or not you answer this. So you're maintaining your nursing license though, is that correct?
Yes.
Even though technically your position, a license is not required.
Correct.
So do you foresee yourself going, you know, to, we kind of talked about this earlier and you can also choose whether or not you want to talk about this, but do you feel that you could ever return to the bedside after having this kind of job? I imagine, you know, even though there are a lot of challenges, it sounds like you also are like, you're out and about. You're not like locked into a unit for 12 hours.
Right. I'm a girl about town.
So you're transporting people. So I take it you have a vehicle that's provided. Okay.
Yes. Ours is a rather large vehicle, like a truck with a covered cab that obviously there's no windows, but we have a cot that we use to transport decedents. We recently, like, this is going to be so nerdy, but we recently got it's called a power load system. So it's a mechanical system that basically all we have to do is hook the bed up and it lifts for us.
This is stuff I get excited about. You tell me I don't have to lift, push, pull.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. I'm going to geek out over that.
Well, yeah, because our cot weighs 125 pounds on its own.
Plus the person
that
may or may not be someone that is significantly larger than you.
Right, exactly. And at scene deaths, you have law enforcement and firefighters if you know, available to help you. But
so you're like, excuse me, Mr. Firefighter, can you come here and help me?
Please help me. Typically we are the only one on call. So when we get back to the morgue, it's us.
It's just you.
Know?
So you've got to know your ergonomics. You've got to know how to move literally dead weight without totally screwing up your back. Yeah.
Right. So this is a huge help to us. Like I'm like, I will transport all day long. it's a piece of cake now, but, that's a helpful part of my job.
And you know, gosh, there's,
oh, okay. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to comment. I think that I will return to the bedside someday or do, you know, something that involves bedside nursing in some way. Because I do miss that. I mean, I love, you know, advocating for people that can't speak, but I do miss patient care in a way. So if I can like find a way to combine, you know, do something on the side, then I would totally do that.
Yeah. God, I have a thousand million bazillion questions. I want to go back to your kind of your Planned Parenthood days.
Yeah. Ask me whatever you want.
Yeah. Cause this is something, you know, this, like I said, I got my start in reproductive healthcare. I think this is really important now, especially as we are having all this legislation and all this shit clogging up people's ability to get safe, affordable, effective healthcare. And, I just wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about, I guess, how that kind of set you up for the rest of your nursing career. Cause I think that there are a lot of foundational things that happen because with reproductive healthcare, there is some level of having to like fight for these rights for this healthcare, as well as also these being really common things, everything from like going in and getting birth control, a pap smear, an STD test, you know, a first trimester abortion, which is all that's really legal. And they're trying to take that shit away too. So there's all these things that we do, like at the clinic that I worked at, we also did sports physicals and free pregnancy testing. And we sold condoms that weren't full of bleach and chemicals. Like there's a million things, but when people think about Planned Parenthood, they think about, oh, it's controversial. They provide abortions and that's tainted things in the media. Like it's either you're for it or you're against it, you know, and there's always protesters out there. So I kind of want to talk about like, what are some things that you took away from working in an environment like that? Because that was like your first big like healthcare job, right? That's what you were saying. It's like, that was the thing that made you go, this is my industry. Like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that for me solidified, like, just like you, you know, it's like we provided all these healthcare resources and exams for all sorts of people, not just abortions, you know, and it just made me like solidify a sense of fierce advocacy for patients, because as I'm sure you probably dealt with, you know, we dealt with protesters who threatened us and, you know, threatened our clinic. And that just really fucking pissed me off. And it was like, people are coming here for healthcare. Like, it's none of your business. Like, you don't have to like this, but don't threaten them or me because I'm providing them with a healthcare service. So I think that really, like, you know, I like the, you know, my mom was a nursing assistant and she had already kind of laid this advocacy groundwork in me, but that really brought it out. And I was like, well, you know, there's patients that have all these different things going on with their lives and they, you know, if I can help them advocate for themselves in any way, then that's what I need to do.
Right. And I feel like I was 18 when I started working there, fresh out of Catholic high school.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think people should be able to tell you what you do with any part of your body. Like,
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And so it kind of awakened a little bit of, even at a young age, the ferocious mama bear in me that is like, you absolutely will not harass these people. Right. They are here. You don't even know what they're here for. You have no idea. And while I'm not an apologist, I'm not someone who says like, oh, but they do more than abortions. I think abortion rights are important. And I think that there's 100,000 different reasons that you can't even imagine why this is important and why. So I don't want to get too far into that tangent because that could turn into hours.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, I mean,
that is worthy of another episode, is talking about reproductive health care rights. So you are invited back anytime you want.
Oh, well, thank you. I will come back anytime. I like awesome. One thing like on this topic sort of about death, like taking from you know, like from reproductive health care back to death.
Oh, all right, guys. I'm going to pull the plug right there, and you're going to have to come back next week for part two of my interview with Nurse Dorothy. Thanks for listening, and happy nursing.
Here at MedRoom Chronicles, we may be uncensored, but we are not unfiltered. Protected health information has been changed and concealed to comply with HIPAA of 1996. The things we talk about are combinations of years of experience with thousands of patients, things we've read, stories we've heard. If you think we're talking about you, trust me, we're not. Also, we're real nurses here to provide accurate and helpful info, but don't take us as fact without doing your own research. Refer to your state's Board of Nursing, Practice Acts, and your institution's policies and procedures if you have questions about your practice. Lastly, our very strong opinions are ours alone and do not reflect those of our employers or educational institutions. Thanks for listening, and happy nursing, guys.